On this episode of Still Loading, the secrets of video game consoles. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I have a special guest for you. As you know, I am a huge fan of video game history, and I've done episodes where I talk about like the Video Game History Foundation. I had Aiden Mower on earlier this year talking about his book on the history of JRPGs, and kind of in the same vein as that, I have another author on the show today to talk about a book that he wrote all about video game history. Today on the show, I have the author and game developer, Michael Hart. Michael, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you once again. I said it off, Mike. I'm going to say it again. Thank you for setting aside some time, especially despite this time difference. We have quite a time difference between us when we're scheduling this recording session. So thank you once again for setting aside some time for this. So to kick off this episode, to kick off this interview, I wanted to get the listeners to know a little bit more about you. Like I said, we're going to dive into the book in earnest, and I have a lot of things to say about it. But before we get into that, for the listeners to know more about you, you have worked in the video game industry for a number of years. So what games have you worked on, and what do you do in the games industry?
Yeah, so I've been part of the video game industry, working in the video game industry for the best part of two decades. In the recent years, I've sort of moved away from video games and moved off to the side, and I'm doing more video streaming software, which works with kind of similar technology. So it's not too far out of left field. But in the video games, I've worked on titles like L.A. Noire, World of Tanks, Death Squared, bunch of mobile games, also a few cancelled games as well. I was working on a game based on Stargate SG-1 in the mid-2000s, which unfortunately got cancelled. But so yeah, I've been around for a while working on various different projects.
What would you say is something that surprised you about the game industry? Because in your about section for the book, you mentioned you've been a gamer since you were a kid, and when you kind of transitioned from being a gamer to a game developer, what was one of the biggest realizations that you note, or biggest changes from that transition?
Nothing really surprised me that much, to be honest, because I knew what the industry was like before I got into it. So. Mm. So yeah, I don't really think there was anything that surprising in there. Maybe learning that not everyone that actually works on games plays games, which does sound a bit weird when you think about it. But yeah, there are people that work in the industry that don't actually play games. So maybe that was a bit surprising to learn.
I could see how that would be surprising. It makes sense, though. I remember, so I went to school for game design, and as you can see, doing absolutely nothing with it. But, well, I guess the podcast is kind of ish, but that's not development at all. But I digress. But I remember learning, like, one of the things that my professor taught me is that it's good to be well-rounded. To be well-read is a very appealing trait to have in someone who does someone who develops games, because it gives them a much broader perspective. So I can see that someone who doesn't play games, it almost kind of frees them from some of the constraints that gamers might put on themselves, because they're like, well, that's not a game that I know, or not a gameplay style that I know. But I'm just going off now. Now, you mentioned before that you worked on L.A. Noire, which is probably, out of the games you listed, the most well-known game, maybe World of Tanks, because it's a mobile game. World of Tanks is mobile, right? Am I brain farting on that? It's a mobile game, right?
There is a mobile version, but it was primarily on PC, and it's on consoles and stuff as well. So it's on like lots of things.
Okay, so maybe World of Tanks then too. But working on L.A. Noire, what was your job on that? Like, what did you do on L.A. Noire?
I was technical tools QA on that. So I was in charge of checking the internal tools that we built, like helping helping the developers develop features for those, and then rolling that out to the studio to use for the artists and animators, designers to use, and supporting those guys when as I'm making the content.
Okay, so you were basically IT for the game engine. I know I'm dumbing it down a lot, but it's...
Am
I correct with that?
Yeah, I guess that's one way to put it, yeah.
I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying it beyond belief. I'm not trying to make it sound that simple.
Yeah.
All right, so you've worked in the game industry for a number of years. When did you first start? And then I want to hear more about the book. But the last question I have for you in terms of your working in the games industry, what was the first title you worked on?
The first title I worked on was a GameCube game called The Polar Express. Ooh. Like it was a game based on the film The Polar Express. Like I don't think it was particularly well known, but
well, you'd be surprised. I actually have some podcasting friends who they changed the name of their show now, but they had a podcast called The GameCube Was Cool, and they talked about it. They did a whole episode on The Polar Express.
Oh, okay.
So there is a chunk of people who know it, believe it or not. But okay, but you've been in the industry since the GameCube, and now, like you said, you're working on video streaming software. So now I do want to transition into what we are actually here to talk about, the core of this conversation, if you will. You wrote a book called The Secrets of Video Game Consoles, and it came out, if I read correctly, last year, right?
Yeah, towards the end of last year, yeah.
Okay. So I got to know I'm sure you get this question a lot, but just so the listeners know, what kind of inspired you to write a book about the secrets of video game consoles?
Yeah. So like yourself and probably many, many of your listeners as well, I am a sucker for video game history. And I really love learning more about it. And I was frustrated when I would look up to try to look up some facts about, you know, various video game consoles, and the facts would just be really quick, one or two sentences, you know, this happened and that's it. You know, there wasn't any further details other than that. And I want to know more details. Like, I want to know why that happened, who was involved, like what was the result of that? You know, well, why was that important? And so I didn't see any resources out there that actually went into the details on those kinds of facts. So I took it upon myself to try and fix that. I wrote a series of articles for a video game website just to test my idea and in the kind of style that I was envisioning. And I got some positive feedback from that. So I decided to go ahead and expand that out into a full book. And, you know, with all the lockdowns that were happening during 2020, that was an ideal time to start doing it.
What I love about your book, and I think you are 100% right, there's not really a good, solid, consolidated source for a lot of, I shouldn't say consolidated, it's harder to, there's a lot of sources that have a lot of video game history consolidated, but I don't feel like it's as it's not organized in an easy enough way for if you don't know what you're looking for, it's hard to find it type of thing. And what I love about your book, and I've had friends of personal friends of mine say, you know, if we'll go to a game convention and I'll just be like, oh, this game, I'll just rattle off facts about, you know, this game or this console or something like that. And they're like, how do you know all that stuff? And a lot of it, that sounds really braggy, and I don't mean it to, but the point I'm trying to make is that's just been from hours of listening to Retronauts and other video game podcasts and doing my own research and, you know, looking up a lot of asks and all these other things that you're just going down rabbit holes to find. And it's a really hard part where if someone's interested in video game history to be like, well, where do I start? I don't have an answer for them. And I'll be honest, and I mean this sincerely, I honestly think your book is a perfect place to start because there's so much information in your book, and it starts from the beginning of the game industry. You the first console you cover is the first official console that was released, the Magnavox Odyssey, and you go all the way up to up to modern consoles. I believe the last one you have was of course the Nintendo Switch. Did you do PS5 and Xbox Series X? I don't remember.
No, I had to stop it. I had to stop at some point. So unfortunately, those consoles didn't make it in.
No, I think, and the information on those are a little bit more readily available than something like the Fairchild Channel F, which listeners, you might be wondering, what the hell is that? Well, that's a damn good question. It's the first console, and you can learn about it more in Michael's book. It's the console with the first swappable cartridges, if I'm remembering correctly, based off your book, right?
The ones that actually had programmable games on them, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So... Yeah, I mean it sincerely, man. Like, I really have enjoyed reading your book. And I guess full disclosure to listeners, I did receive a review copy of this book for this episode, and I've read about 10 chapters of it, and I'm really enjoying it. It's very dense, and there's so many fun facts, and I really love that, like you mentioned when you kind of talked about, or like you mentioned when you spoke about why you wanted to write the book, and how you'll find all these lists of fun facts of video games, but it's just a little bullet point and then there's nothing more. What I love is that you split everything up and you add so much context to each fact, where there's almost like a bunch of other small facts built inside this one main one that you wanted to talk about. So what I want to ask you next, though, is how did you go around? What was the process in which you picked and choose which facts to include in the book?
Well, what I was actually trying to do was focus on facts that may not be as widely known as other ones. Mm-hmm. So that's what I tried to focus on at first, like stuff that, you know, if you're familiar with the video game industry. You know, facts that maybe you might not know, or facts that you maybe do know, but you don't know the full story of. And so that's what I tried to focus on. So not so much the really well-known ones, but more so the ones that may not be as widely known, and then expand upon those.
I think that is a smart way to do it, especially like I mentioned before, you go back to the original home console, the Magnavox Odyssey, which listeners may find interesting. It's that console was so primitive, might be too strong of a term, but it's so different from what we're used to now. It's not like there was programmable cartridges that you could swap in and out. Everything was hard coded directly onto the console. I know I'm kind of simplifying that, but like hard coded directly onto the console. So it's not like you could buy the console and then buy six or seven games and then swap those games out for another six or seven. No, you were stuck with whatever was put on the console, which, how many games were on the original Magnavox Odyssey?
Well, it wasn't so much that, because it did actually have swappable games, but the way it worked was, I mean, you may be confusing that with the, like the dedicated systems that followed it. But the original Odyssey did actually have swappable games, but the way it worked was that the console itself was only capable of displaying three dots in a line to the television screen. And all it was a series of transistors and diodes, basically. And the game cards that you got, when you put them into the console, basically just rewired the circuitry basically in a way to display those three dots in the line in a slightly different way. And so that's how that console worked. Like, so there wasn't actually any game code on those game cards at all. All it was a way to sort of rejig the circuitry in the console to display those three dots in a line in a slightly different way on the TV. And like, there wasn't any kind of record like scoring or anything. Like, there was, the console couldn't actually do any calculations or anything like that. You know, the players, you know, had to penalize themselves if they did something wrong. That's basically how it works. Like, it was after that where they started pushing out like the sort of dedicated Pong systems. That's when the sort of Pong craze started after that, where you had all these dedicated systems, not just from Magnavox, but other manufacturers as well. Like, even
Sears.
Yeah, Sears. Like Atari did it. Even Nintendo had some systems that they did back then. So those dedicated systems were after that, and then it wasn't really until the Fairchild Channel F came along where we actually had programmable games on the and actual proper game cartridges.
I think one of the most fascinating things to me that I learned from your book about the Odyssey specifically is that a lot there was physical accessories that came with the system, almost like board game pieces that were meant to be played in conjunction with what was happening on the screen. And you have a picture from the you got from Wikimedia Commons of all the different, like, it almost looks like Monopoly. I'm not gonna lie, it looks like Monopoly pieces with like poker chips and stuff like that. It's absolutely wild. I had no idea there was stuff like that for the system.
Yeah, neither did I really until I started researching it. So like that was one of the cool parts about researching a book like this. And like I did a lot of research on it. Finding out stuff about that, finding out about especially the light gun that came with the system. Like you would, like I didn't include a picture of it in the book, but I mean it was wild. Like you would never get away with releasing a sort of a gun like accessory toy to a video game console that looked like that. In the modern day, it actually looked like a real bona fide rifle. Like it was crazy. Like it didn't look like a toy at all.
That reminds me, didn't like Konami for the Famicom have something like that? There was like a submachine, maybe not Konami, but I've seen videos of it online. Shout out to a previous guest of the show, Game Dave, in his Famicorner videos on YouTube. He demonstrated one where it just looks like a submachine gun. It's like painted black and it looks like a real submachine gun that you're using as a light gun. It's just it's one of the wildest things I've ever seen. I think it's one of my favorite things about game history, and I've said this on other shows, it's where you look at something and you look at something that like a console manufacturer or a game developer, depending on the situation, did. And it was so far ahead of its time. You can't believe that it actually existed for something back then. The example I always like to give, actually I'll give one from your book. Atari had wireless controllers using radio. If I'm remembering correctly, I can't speak. Kind of in the same way the WaveBirds did for the GameCube. Like I didn't know Atari had authentic wireless controllers, which apparently didn't work awful, but they were it still wasn't great either.
Yeah, I mean they did work surprisingly well for what they were. They did have some drawbacks, like because like they used radio waves, like the signal could get interrupted by, you know, anything from, you know, radio controlled cars to microwaves. but also like that they needed batteries and they were quite heavy. So, and the batteries didn't last all that long. But I mean, for what they were, they actually worked reasonably well. And because they worked on radio waves, you know, they didn't need line of sight to the console or anything to work. Mm-hmm. Unlike something like the Sega remote pads that they did for the Mega Drive, they used infrared, so they actually had to have a line of sight to the console. They did actually work reasonably well for what they were, you know, and being the first, you know, wireless controllers for a console. You'd maybe expect them to be awful, but they really weren't.
What was something that you learned in researching this book? Like, I mean, you learned, obviously, like you said, you learned a whole bunch of new things as you did research. Or what was something that stands out to you that was particularly like, holy shit, this like it just blew your mind when you first learned about it?
Something that I think was particularly interesting to find out was that the Nintendo 64's joystick was not actually technically an analog stick. Like I don't think you've got to the Nintendo 64 chapter yet, so I might be.
No, I'm in the middle of NES. I'm actually midway through NES, and I'm annoyed that I don't. So I'm a little behind the scenes for the listeners. The reason I couldn't quite get as far as I wanted, I do a lot of podcast work at home. So I read during my lunch like every day for the last like 2 weeks. I would read like a chapter or two on my work lunch, which I don't get a long one. So I read as much as I could. I promise I'm going to be reading more even after this interview was recorded. But sorry, go on. So yeah. The N64.
That's right. So I hope I'm not dropping too much of a spoiler here. But
No, by all means.
A lot of people think that the stick on the Nintendo 64 was analog, and it actually wasn't. The way it worked was actually digital. It just had so many points of articulation that it was, you know, effectively felt like an analog stick. And it was not the first console to even have like an analog style stick either. So neither was the Atari 5200 for that matter. A lot of people might think that was the first console, but no, there was something that came before that. And it was a series of consoles. It is covered in the book, but there was this series of consoles that came in all kinds of
brands. I know what you're talking about. I can scroll down to it. The Interton video computer?
Yeah. So there was some made by Interton, some made by Radofin, some made by some other manufacturers. There was actually a lot. They were mostly exclusive to Europe, but they were actually the first consoles to have an analog stick. And they even did it better than Atari did when they did it like some 5 years later or so, because they actually, recentered, that they self-centered when you let them go, which
the 5200 did not.
It did not, no. that was one of the many issues that thing had, but...
To put it mildly.
Yeah.
That console is just one of those ones where it's like, I would love to, so I'm a collector, and it would be something I would love to own for collecting reasons, but it's never something where it's like, I'd have to see it at a yard sale. You know what I mean? I'm not going to go out of my way to get a console. I probably won't ever even touch, because I think you even talk about it in the book, like most of the games on it were not exclusive, and the ports of it, while they were good, you could get equally as good ports on like the ColecoVision or something like that for the most part.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't worth the upgrade to buy a whole new equivalent of now $700 console just to play a better version of Donkey Kong or something like that.
Yeah. And when the Atari engineers were actually like, even when they didn't like the joysticks, you know, something was wrong with them. Which I do cover in the book, how the Atari engineers, you know, they were pleading with management not to go to market with those sticks, but they went to market anyway because they were worried about the competition. So
when you were writing your book, what was something that you didn't expect to, like, what was something unexpectedly difficult that you encountered while writing? And as a counterpoint to that, what was something unexpectedly easy that occurred while writing?
There were a couple of times where, you know, I started investigating, you know, a fact that, you know, a lot of people seem to know, like, happened, but I couldn't actually find any reliable source for it. Which was interesting. Like like I would find the source which didn't have any references, and any other sources I found just linked back to that original source which didn't have any references. So there were a number of times where I couldn't actually verify exactly what was going on, and so so that there might be like two or three different stories about the same thing that I found, and like none of which were, you know, verifiably true. So I would put both the stories down into the book and let the reader decide, you know, which one they choose to believe. And that was the way I had to go about doing that. I couldn't say, you know, factually one way or the other what happened. So I say, okay, well, some sources say this and some sources say this. And so, you know,
you kind of just had to share each narrative that was given for it.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't want to, you know, dismiss one or the other. So I'll put them both down. There were a few cases like that where I had to do that. So that was probably hard. In some way, like I wanted to get, you know, a full fact, yet this is exactly what happened. But it didn't work out that way when I started researching it. So
then I guess conversely, was there anything that was surprisingly easy that you encountered while writing? Or was there anything like that you knew that you wouldn't have to do much research on?
No, like even the stuff that I thought might have been easy, I did a lot of research on it anyway, because I wanted to make sure I got everything correct. So, you know, I might have heard something, you know, that I had believed for years. And, you know, but like I still wanted to, you know, research that and make sure that what I was saying was actually right and not just, you know, something that I heard in the grapevine, you know, years and years ago. So like even
yeah, I gotcha.
I mean, stuff like, you know, you're in the Nintendo Entertainment System chapter now. So like I talk in there about the origins of the Konami code. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty well known that it didn't come from Contra. I mean, some people may still believe that it did start from Contra, but it didn't. But like I think it's reasonably well known that it didn't start from Contra now, that it started from Gradius. But, you know, so like I knew that already, but I still wanted to research the facts just to make sure I got the story correct. So
no, and that was interesting too, because it still happens in modern Konami games. Like you'll still see it appearing up to this day. Actually, here's a fun fact with the Konami code. There is, as a father yourself, you might have gotten some of these. You ever see those little toy video game controllers? Like they're like Fisher Price video game controllers. And there's a little Game Boy looking one, and there's another one that looks kind of like a 360 controller. If you input the Konami code on those, it plays a little ditty.
Oh, okay.
It plays like nothing crazy. It's because it just plays music for when the kids hit the buttons. It's meant for toddlers, pretty much, like toddlers and really young kids. But if you input the Konami code, they coded it into it. It does a little extra ditty that you wouldn't hear otherwise, which I find kind of amusing. Now, I wanted to ask, since you worked in the game industry, was there anything that from your experience of working in the games industry that you were that you found was applicable when writing and researching this book?
Yeah, quite a lot. So like even with the consoles that I didn't work on, there were a bit before I got into the industry. When I started researching like how they worked on the hardware level, my knowledge of like the video game industry allowed me to understand that better, and then try and put that down into words, into the book, into a language that people could understand. So that really helped in that regard. But particularly when I was getting to some consoles that I did work on, like the PlayStation 2, for example. I go into some depth there, and the PlayStation 3 as well, about how their CPU architecture worked. With the PS2, it was the Emotion Engine, and with the PS3, it was the Cell. You know, they were notoriously difficult for developers to work on.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. So, and my knowledge of like how those machines worked definitely came in handy when I was writing those chapters, for sure.
And this is something that I want to maybe either correct or clarify for my own edification about, like, something that I understood about the PlayStation 3, but maybe someone who's worked on it can actually confirm that I'm right, or just tell me I'm just dead wrong with it. Is it true that the system had like a seven core processor? There was like one core was dedicated to the operating system, and the other six were basically for what the games were playing, or something along those lines.
It actually had nine, believe it or not.
Nine core.
Yeah. So the cell itself was comprised of eight, and there was an additional one on top of that. But some of them were actually redundant and not actually used. So it was an odd architecture for sure, but they designed it in a way where, you know, they wanted you to sort of have like a lot of the cores inside the cell working together. But one of them was reserved for the operating system, and another one or two were not actually used. It was a bit weird. It had eight SPEs, or synergetic processing elements. and then an additional PPE or power processing element. The PPE was like if you're familiar with how the Xbox 360 works, like the Xbox 360 basically had three of those inside its main CPU.
Okay.
So it was a reasonably powerful chip in itself, but then you had the eight SPEs that developers also had to utilize as well. So it was a kind of a mess to sort through. But I mean, once you actually did understand and utilize it, it could do some pretty amazing stuff.
I could see. I mean, you can usually tell what a system's capable of at the end of its life cycle with the games coming out at the end of its life cycle. And the games coming out at the end of the 360 and PS3 era, specifically for the PS3, like, I still think the original Last of Us still looks really good even today. And that I don't know, that game always just blew me away. We'll get back to the book in a second. I have one other question about game development. In your personal opinion, what was your least favorite console to develop for? What was one of the hardest ones that just was a pain in the butt every time you had to make a game for it?
Probably a PlayStation 2.
Really? Okay. Yeah. What about the PS2 made it so much more difficult than, like, say, the GameCube or something, or one of its contemporaries?
It was more so the it was difficult hardware to understand for a start, which I sort of touched on with the Immersion Engine CPU, but it was also the developer support or lack thereof, I should say. Mm-hmm. Unless you're a first-party Sony developer, I should say, they didn't really provide you a lot of support. They just dumped a stack of thick manuals down onto your desk and basically said, there you go. And, I do cover it, like, in the book, another developer described it, which, was pretty similar to my own experience. That's, like, in sort of complete... opposite to, say, how Microsoft approached the Xbox, the original Xbox, which made it made it really easy to develop on. Like, they had nice integration with Visual Studio, and like they had a lot of nice developer support. So that was like a total opposite. Like, the original Xbox was really nice to work on, but the PlayStation 2 was not.
That's what I have heard. And there, I think, what is the YouTube channel, Modern Vintage Gamer, he's done videos about how difficult it was for the developers to work on these systems. Now going back to the book, I was curious. I wanted to indulge some of my curiosities there. Going back to the book, is there a specific chapter that you felt was like that you were particularly proud of, or that had a lot more information than you were expecting to get out of it, or specific console, I guess, for that matter?
That's a good question. I'm proud of all the chapters, honestly. It was really fun to actually go back to some stuff that happened between Sony and Sega during the launch of the PS1 and the Saturn.
Yeah.
And, everyone's seen the video, I'm sure, of, that E3 conference where, Sega had previously got up and tried to one-up Sony by saying, hey, the Saturn's, available right now and you can buy it for $399. And, and Sony, when they came up for their, E3 presentation, the guy had these pages of notes so that he got up to the stage, looked down these pages of notes, and then just said $299 into the microphone, and that was it. The crowd roared, and that was that basically sealed Sega's fate, like, with the Saturn in North America, at least. I'm sure, like, everyone's seen that famous video because it's like all over the internet, but it was really fun to actually go back and see that stuff. Like, in the same vein, like, you may have read this part already, the sort of original console war between Mattel with their Intellivision and Atari. Those ads, the ads that Mattel ran for the Intellivision specifically, that were like that they went straight for Atari's throat. Like you wouldn't mm-hmm. be able to get away with doing this kind of stuff anymore. But like they went for it, and making these ads with George Plimpton, the sports guy, and because Intellivision did have a lot of sports games, so going back and like watching those ads, because most of them are available on YouTube and whatever, people have uploaded them. And just to see how direct they were attacking Atari, and Atari fired back. Like they didn't take it lying down, but they didn't. They didn't mention Mattel or Intellivision by name. They were just mentioning the competition. But Mattel didn't shy away from mentioning Atari by name at all, and saying, "Hey, this is what Atari's done, but we've done this so much better," kind of thing. So. So that was kind of fun, like watching those ads, because they are kind of funny, looking back at them now and thinking, you'd never be able to get away with like directly attacking a competitor like that in your advertising these days. So
when you referenced all the stuff happening with, Intellivision and Atari and all that stuff, I did a bonus episode for my patrons called The Wild West of Gaming. What I talked about is this era that you're talking about is just, it was such a weird time, because a lot of the game, I think it's one of the strangest things, because you would never see it today. Actually, you might start seeing it a little bit more today, but where, I found it amusing that Atari, Mattel, and Coleco all had separate divisions of their companies that were dedicated to developing and publishing games on competitors' consoles.
Yeah.
I just think that's like one of the wildest ideas I've ever seen. And what is it? The Blue Sky Rangers was the one group for Intellivision. Am I remembering that correctly? Or was it Coleco? I'm blanking on it. I'll double check on that. But I just found that. So it's just such a bizarre thing. And like, it's so weird to see them just go hog wild against each other. Like you said, it's basically pre-Sega. It was like Sega before Sega, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yes, Blue Sky Rangers was a group of Intellivision game programmers who previously worked at Mattel in the early 80s, and then they Don Daglow was part of them. There's a whole bunch. M Network was Mattel, I guess they were part of M Network, which was Mattel's branch that published on Atari's video VCS. Like, it's, I don't know, this whole thing is just wild. I did a little mini episode just kind of going through what the three companies were and like how they kind of arranged with each other. I'm sorry, I cut you off though. You were saying something?
Yeah, no, it's okay. I was going to mention that you brought up how they were making games for the competitors' consoles, but what was interesting about that is that they made deliberately inferior versions of those games. So
that is something I learned from your book. I forgot. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, the Intellivision, the original Intellivision, was the first console I owned, and one of the first games I remember playing on it was the original Donkey Kong. But that port of Donkey Kong was absolutely terrible. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen the Intellivision port of Donkey Kong, but it was awful. But because like Coleco had the rights to Donkey Kong at the time. So, and the ColecoVision port of Donkey Kong is fantastic. But the Intellivision port is complete shite. It was only two levels. It sounded awful. It controlled awful. Like, it was a bad, bad port. I mean, I still played it. I still loved it because it was what I had. I didn't know any better. But that was common practice too. Like, there's, the players in the industry would put out, these products that they had the licenses to on the competing consoles, but they would make them deliberately inferior to make their own versions and their own consoles look better in comparison to the competition. And yes, some of them, like the both in Coleco and Mattel, with the ColecoVision and Intellivision, even made an add-on for their systems that played Atari 2600 games. Mm-hmm. Which isn't something like, can you imagine, like, you know, Microsoft making an add-on for, you know, the did the Xbox to play PlayStation games. You know, it wouldn't, like, you can't do that. But because the 2600 was basically built with off-the-shelf components, like, there wasn't really anything there that was proprietary. You know, they were able to do that. And Atari tried to shut them down, and they were unsuccessful. And so, you know, I think that they got as far as, like, the courts telling, you know, the competition, oh, you need to pay Atari royalties. But other than that, you're free to do it. And so they're like, okay, yeah, we don't mind. We can do that. So, it was a wild time back then.
And you talk about it in the book as well. I think it's relatively common knowledge, but I still think I'm glad you touched on it. Actually, sorry, before I go into what I was going to say, one thing about Intellivision I love that you brought up was Utopia. Now, I have not personally played Utopia, but I did a whole series on the history of RTS games for my podcast, and when I got to Utopia, I was just blown away by what that game could do on the system that it was on for the year it came out. I found a couple games a little bit older with like RTS roots, but nothing that direct. Like you mentioned in the book, like it's one of the most direct predecessors to what the RTS genre would become.
Especially on the console too.
Yeah. It's crazy impressive. Now, what I was going to say earlier, though, the video game crash of 1983, I'm curious, my understanding was that the crash was more North America specific. It did have ripple effects outside of North America, of course, but like it was still, you know, games were still popular in Japan. The Famicom came out in 83, and what is it, the Sega SG-1000 came out in 83, I think on the same day, actually. It's the Famicom, oddly enough. But like over in Australia, I know you would have been pretty young in 83. You would have only been a few years old. But did the crash affect Australia at all? Like, did the crash in North America affect Australia all that much?
Not as far as I know. No, like we were pretty. It didn't really affect Australia or Europe really that much. I mean, I don't directly remember it, but, you know, when I researched it, you know, I found that, you know, it really didn't, it was really only a North American thing. So it is interesting that, you know, when you ask, you know, someone, you know, what the most important console of all time was, like on that note, you know, if you speak to someone in North America, they might say the Nintendo Entertainment System, because that was, you know, what sort of rescued that industry out of that huge recession that was in. And so they hold it up on a pretty high pedestal and say, well, we wouldn't be where we are without that. And that's fair enough. But, you know, because the industry crash didn't really affect Japan or Europe or like other regions like Australia that much, you know, originally, Nintendo Entertainment System, you know, was actually outsold by the Mega Drive in a lot of those regions.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not the Mega Drive, the Master System. You knew what I meant.
I was just like down along. Yeah, you're right. I'm like, I forgot Mega Drive is, you know, the Genesis here in North America. But yeah, sorry, go on. The Master System.
I meant the Master System, the, you know, Sega's console before that. It was actually outside by the Master System in some of those regions. So, and computing systems like the Commodore 64 and Apple II and, those kinds of things, like that, they were also popular. So, yeah, it didn't really affect other regions outside North America that much. It was pretty much a North American thing.
And I always find that interesting. I did an episode on the Sega Master System. But like, you're 100% right. Like it sold so much better than like the NES. Obviously was king in North America, but outside of it, especially, and you mentioned in the book, Brazil, where it is still being made to this day, sort of, and like these weird, like almost NES classic style consoles, but they keep coming out. Like, it's still popular. It technically has not been discontinued. It is an 8-bit video game system from the 80s that technically has not been discontinued in Brazil, of all places.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
I'm going to actually quick shout out a podcasting friend of mine, Retro Hangover, my buddies Chris and Shane over there. They have a series on their Patreon called Growing Up Gaming, where they interview people who grew up gaming outside of North America, because they both grew up here, or grew up where, you know, I'm at in North America. So they obviously, we only have that very limited, narrow perspective. So they have a whole series called Growing Up Gaming, where they interview people who grew up gaming in Cuba, Puerto Rico. They did Australia, they've done Portugal, and they did Brazil, which I think is I have not listened to yet, actually. I think I should, because that sounds really interesting. Also, the most recent one they did, they Growing Up Gaming Latter-day Saints. So you got a bunch of Mormons going on over here. That's got to be an interesting episode too. Actually, another friend of the show, Cade from Gaming Memories, was on that episode. But anyway, so in your opinion, just kind of talking about game history in general, what would you say is your personal favorite era of, like, or let me put it this way. I have two questions here. They're all kind of popped in my head at once. One, what do you think is, what is your personal favorite era of game history? Like, what's something that you find the most interesting, whether it's because of a personal connection or just stuff that you've learned? Like, what, maybe it's a specific console, or maybe it's just a specific generation. What is your, what era of gaming do you find the most interesting?
I definitely have a soft spot for, like, the early to mid 90s. That's the sort of 16-bit generation.
Mm-hmm. Mega Drive, Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Others. TurboGrafx. I don't know. Yeah. Was that called TurboGrafx for you guys in Australia as well? Or was it the PC Engine?
We unfortunately never officially got it here. It was never officially released here, which I'm still upset about. But the Super Nintendo is my favorite console of all time. It's just got so many good games on it. Back then, you may have experienced the same thing in North America. It was like Sega versus Nintendo, and so Sega's advertising campaigns with, Sega does want Nintendo into that kind of thing. I think the Mega Drive sold slightly better than the Super Nintendo did here. But it was very much a Sega versus Nintendo thing. Like, there wasn't really much sitting on the fence, right? You were in one camp or the other. Similar kind of vibe, like in the arcade scene at the time, with stuff like Mortal Kombat versus Street Fighter 2 and that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, like, as I got older, like, I revisited those Sega games, which I sort of passed off at the time when I was younger, because I was like, Nintendo's the best. I went back to the Sega games and said, hey, you know what? Yeah, these are all pretty good. So I do appreciate games from both platforms. And I've also, gone to play, some TurboGrafx games, because, as I said, that was never released here. So I've taken the opportunity to go back and experience some of them as well, which I never got the chance to. So I really loved that kind of generation of games, because I think that was really peak 2D gaming at the time. Mm-hmm. The previous platforms, they kind of built that foundation, but when the 16-bit generation came along, it was like, yeah, like, this is it. And obviously, like, that was a big jump into the 3D generation after that. Mm-hmm. You look back at a lot of those early gen 3D games now, and they're really hard to go back to. They don't look particularly good. They don't play particularly well, because the developers were still trying to figure out how to design games in 3D spaces. But you go back to those 16-bit games, and they still hold up. Like, they're still fantastic. They still hold up. So,
well, most of them, not all of them, but a good
least, yeah.
I and that's a very good point. I do think the evolution of 3D gaming has taken a little bit longer to master its craft than 2D gaming. Like 2D gaming got it pretty much in, you know, it went, I mean, I guess if you count Atari, it's three generations, you know, Atari up to NES, and then obviously peaked at Super Nintendo. Well, I shouldn't say peaked, but that was its peak in the market, I should say. And then with 3D gaming, obviously the early 3D games, there's some good ones, but you're right, a lot of them are super rough around the edges. Even some of the good ones have like people always talk about their love of GoldenEye for the N64. Mm-hmm. I love GoldenEye for the N64. Controls don't hold up all that well. It's a little hard to grasp. I think it's better than people give it credit for. I think a lot of it's now become, you know, the commonly accepted thing just to shit on GoldenEye's controls. I don't think they're that bad, but they're definitely nowhere near as good as you remember them being. But then you get to the PS2 era, and the PS2, like, there's still a lot of PS2 games that hold up, but I would almost say like PS2 had the most innovation, and then the PS3 is like, now we're used to what, you know, the most common control schemes, you know, that's what we're used to with the PS3, Xbox 360, that whole era. But I don't know, I'm always interested in seeing how games evolve. I feel like 3D gaming took just a smidge longer to kind of refine their design to make it a little bit more palatable to everyone. Now, the other question I was going to ask, I referenced before, I asked about your favorite era. I had two questions. And the other question is, what era or console era, whatever you want to, or whatever you're more interested in, but what era or console of gaming do you feel is underrepresented when talked about? You know, what's an era of gaming that doesn't get talked about enough? Or maybe it's even a genre, maybe it's a specific system. Like, what's something in your opinion that just, it doesn't get enough love, and you wish it got some more focus put on it?
I mean, we spoke about it earlier with the Fairchild Chun Lef, I think, because that is, like, if you ask me what the most important console of all time was, I would say that, because, like, that was, as we were talking about earlier, like, that was the first console to actually have programmable game cartridges.
Shout out Jerry Lawson.
Yep. And you know, it pioneered a lot of other things too, like, you know, how like some controller functions worked with the joysticks and that kind of thing. And it were, you know, and not many people seem to even know it exists, let alone, you know, acknowledge it for what it is. I mean, yeah, it didn't sell particularly well, especially once the Atari 2600 or the VCS at the time hit the market, you know, and like it was soundly outsold, and like it eventually, you know, was discontinued. But, you know, without that system, I don't think games would be where they are today. And it's really like how they did it, like, you know, how they, you know, sort of engineered not just the console, but how the cartridges worked as well. Because this hadn't been done before, right? So, like,
yeah,
you might take it for granted that, you know, you take like a, you know, a game cartridge and slot it into, you know, your Super Nintendo, or like your little game card and put it into your Nintendo Switch or whatever. But like, this was the first time anyone did this kind of thing. And so they had to sort of try and engineer these cartridges, say, okay, well, yeah, well, we can let the user take them in and out to change their games, but like, how do we stop them electrocuting themselves? You know, it's but because, like, well, you're dealing with electronic circuits here, right? So how do you do that? So the way they actually, that their thought process and how they engineered that kind of stuff was like really fascinating, and I don't think it's given enough credit, you know, in the whole scheme of things.
No, I agree with you, especially considering just how much, I mean, like, swappable cartridges. Like, I feel like there's a handful of developments in the games industry that I feel like doesn't get talked about enough. I think that's obviously one of them. We wouldn't have literally anything that we're used to now with, you know, swappable discs or swappable. I mean, how we still are using swappable cartridges with the Nintendo Switch. It still is a thing. And that's all the way back to the Fairchild Channel F. I also think one of my personal things is, like, I like finding connections to people in the game industry that like did a lot of stuff that you might not have heard of. Now, people in, you know, probably people who listen to this podcast and others, but like, and other people in who like video game history know this man, but Gunpei Yokoi, like he, you know, besides creating the Game Boy and the Virtual Boy, but besides creating that, he also, you know, created Game Watch and the D-pad, and then also made a bunch of toys for Nintendo. And I feel like while in our circles, people know about him, but I feel like in general, people like those are huge, major, important, maybe not the Virtual Boy, but those are huge, important changes, evolutionary steps, specifically the D-pad. Like if we don't get the D-pad, so much of gaming is defined by what Yokoi came up with on the D-pad. And I really wish more people would. I did an episode years ago about him, but it's been some time. I need to do another episode on like I started a series, and it's only been one episode. And it was on him. It was a game industry legends profile. So I did kind of like a little talk about, you know, what, you know, Yokoi's life and whatnot. And I haven't really done one since, and it's been like 7 years. So maybe I should get back on that. I wanted to ask you, is there any consoles that you didn't include in this book that you kind of wish you did? There's a lot of obscure consoles out there. Obviously, you can't write about all of them, but is there any ones that you didn't get to put in the book that you kind of wish you would have had, you would have been able to, and you couldn't, whether it's because of lack of facts to find, or it's harder to research, or just, you know, lack of space? Are there any consoles that you wanted to touch on, but you just couldn't?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned a list of consoles at the beginning of the book that I don't cover. Like out of that list, like maybe the 3DO might have been interesting to try and cover, given mm-hmm. that was one of the earliest consoles to actually be built with CD-based technology. Because, I mean, CD, like games were on CDs before the 3DO, but they were mostly with like add-ons to like the TurboGrafx and the Mega Drive. And I like, so the 3DO was one of the earliest, alongside, you know, some other stuff like the Amiga CD32 that were built with CD technology. Aside from that, like, you know, I look at that list of other games and other game consoles, and I see, you know, stuff like the Funtek Super A-Can and the FM Towns Marty and the Casio Loopy. Yeah, I'm not really too upset that I didn't manage to include them.
It's funny you mentioned the FM Towns Marty. And yes, listeners, that is a real console. FM space Towns space Marty. That is a real console name.
It is.
Legit, ever since we started talking about some of these consoles, I'm like, I was Googling for the last 5 minutes while we were speaking, like, what the fuck was that name? That, because there's the FM Towns Marty, there was like a version of it that you could put inside a car too, if I remember correctly. I could be completely misremembering, but it was just such a like, what a weird idea. Japan had so many, like the US in the early in the late 70s and early 80s, Japan also had a huge bizarre bunch of obscure consoles that we never got over in the US, probably for good reason, or outside of Japan. We never got outside of Japan, probably for good reason, or for one reason or another. I don't have too many more questions to ask you, but I did want to at least touch on a little bit about your YouTube channel, if that's okay. You have a YouTube channel called White_Pointer Gaming. And
that's right.
What bits of content do you do over there? I mean, I can look up your video list, but I would, you know, from your own, in your own words, what type of content do you make over there?
I do a little bit of everything. I focus like quite a bit on sort of retro topics, but I also dive into some videos, do go into some sort of technical aspects behind games or game consoles. Some other videos might just be like a simple, you know, guide on how to beat a certain boss in a video game. You know, it's not really all that focused. It's just, you know, anything that I find interesting to make a video about, really. Yeah, it's a hobby of mine. Like, it's not like it's a source of income or anything, but because it's only a small channel. But Yeah, I have fun doing it. You know, I'm finishing up a series of videos right now, actually, on mature themed Super Nintendo games.
Mm.
And you know, the previous video I did there was like 3D Metroidvanias that are not Metroid Prime. Like Metroid Prime is one of my favorite games of all time. They put out there; it's in my top five easily, and the remaster is excellent. But not a lot of people realize that there are other, you know, 3D Metroidvanias out there that are not Metroid Prime, and so like I've done a couple of videos on that topic now. So, whatever floats my boat really at the time is what I'll make a video about. So it's a fun hobby.
I was going to ask, in speaking of the Metroidvanias, I believe, I don't know if you included this on your list, on any of your lists or not, isn't Batman Arkham Asylum technically a 3D Metroidvania?
It is. That's in the first video I did, yeah.
That's in the first video. Okay, there we go. I that's one of my favorite games. And Metroid Prime, you're going to kind of laugh at me, actually. I've never beaten Metroid Prime, but not because I disliked it. I got to literally the final area where like you actually have to fight Metroids, and they scared me too bad because they would just, you know, they clump on top of you and start sucking out your energy. I'm like, I don't know what to do, and I just panic really hard. It doesn't work. Metroid is one of those series where I've always had a love for them, and I don't play enough of the games. I've really only beaten Super Metroid, but I really love everything about the series despite having only been able to really beat one of them. So I digress, sorry. To start wrapping up the episode though, I want to kind of bring it back to you a little bit and just talk about some of your gaming memories. I'm going to take a cue from my buddy over at the Gaming Memories podcast and talk a bit about your gaming experience. Like you mentioned before, your favorite console was the Super Nintendo. So was that you mentioned before your first console was the Intellivision, right? Or ColecoVision?
The Intellivision was my first one.
Intellivision. Yeah. Okay. So I guess what's one of the earliest gaming memories you have? Like what's one of the first games you remember playing?
I think I mentioned this before, but the original Donkey Kong on Intellivision was one of the first games I remember. Also Q-Bert. I have this distinct memory of playing Q-Bert, but I think even before we even had Intellivision, like my dad had some of those Game & Watches. And I'll often play those, and that was kind of my first exposure to video games in a way. And then it grew from there. And in particularly, like I think I mentioned this before, but like I have really fond memories of that kind of period in like the early 90s. You know, we're not just, you know, the 16-bit consoles, but also the arcade scene at the time. I love going to arcades and playing games and, you know, sitting on the Mortal Kombat machine and, you know, beating the challenges that came along. But yeah, I mean, I've got memories throughout all facets.
All of the consoles and whatnot, like just throughout the, since you started playing games.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had several friends. I knew more people that owned Master Systems than Nintendo Entertainment Systems back in the 80s. I remember like going over their houses to play, you know, specifically to play the Master System. You know, there was, you know, playing their games like Shinobi and, you know, Wonder Boy, Alex Kidd in Miracle World. You know,
East, any East fans out there?
I didn't play the East games, but they were like RPGs. So I was like not really the kind of, you know, games that would be suitable to play, you know, just to if you're visiting a friend.
That's true.
You know, I didn't cover the portable systems in this particular book because I just wanted to keep the scope to the home consoles. But, you know, I owned an Atari Lynx. Like that was the first sort of portable video game system I had. And I've got a lot of fond memories of playing games on that because one of my friends had the Lynx. And I played it at his house and I'm like, oh, this is awesome. I need one of these. So, so I asked for a Lynx for my, you know, next birthday or Christmas or whenever it was. Right up, like, you know, I mentioned like through the 90s, you know, I think that the first console I actually purchased with my own money because I was working by then and I was earning mm-hmm. a wage, and like the first console I purchased was a GameCube.
Okay.
Unless you count the Game Boy, because I did buy myself a Game Boy when I was younger.
I honestly count handhelds, because I feel like handhelds, just as much as home consoles, are they are consoles. Yeah. That take you to they give you games to play that take you to different worlds that you wouldn't get to experience otherwise.
Yeah.
And especially once, like, if it's all ports, then it's like, I still count it, but it's kind of like a lame duck one. I don't know. That's neither here nor there. I almost got my hands on a Microvision a couple of years ago, but that fell through, unfortunately. I've been dying to get my hands on one of those, because I feel like that's such a, I'm not saying they're good, I don't know what the games are like, but I'm just fascinated by the concept of them.
I've also got memories of like playing PC games as well.
Oh, okay.
We had a like MS-DOS based PC, and so like I learned a lot of my
coding.
My computer coding knowledge and stuff from that time.
You had to.
But like those old DOS games were like excellent. Still has so many fond memories of playing those. So stuff like, Wolfenstein 3D, Jazz Jackrabbit, mm-hmm. Commander Keen. There's, so much good stuff from that era. Warcraft. I was playing games on PC as well as consoles. Like I wasn't picky about it.
a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
One last question before we do our plugs and everything. You said your favorite console was the Super Nintendo. If you could give me just a quick list of some of your favorite games on the Super Nintendo, just because I'll take any chance I can to talk about Super Nintendo games. I don't talk about SNES games enough on my show. So anyway, what are just some of your favorite Super Nintendo games?
Off the top of my head, Donkey Kong Country 2, Super Metroid, Battletoads and Battlemaniacs, funnily enough. Like I really love that game. Okay. I could beat that game without even being hit.
Too bored. oh my god.
And that's a hard game.
It is a very hard game.
Well, like Star Fox or Star Wing, as we called it. It was called here.
Mm-hmm.
Super Mario Kart, Tetris Attack, Axelay, really good shoot 'em up. There's so many good games in that system. Like the port of Mortal Kombat 2 was excellent.
Even though it didn't have blood?
Mortal Kombat 2 did. It was just the original one.
The original. Yeah.
Yeah, the original port wasn't that great. I mean, not really specifically because of the lack of blood, but because the controls were like really laggy for some reason. There was horrible input lag. But Mortal Kombat 2, that was as arcade perfect as you could get at the time. Like that was an amazing port. Street Fighter 2 as well on there. Killer Instinct, the Final Fantasies that were released.
There's
on
so
there.
Many good games on that system.
Secret of Mana. Yeah.
You might, since it's going to be coming out soon, you might get a kick out of this. I'm going to shout out a series I was on, just thinking of a combination of everything that you've been talking about, like some of your memories between Super Nintendo and PC gaming and whatnot. I mentioned before my friends over at the Retro Hangover podcast, and they have a series called King of Games. And King of Games is basically a tournament round, like a tournament where they pick a year. So this one that's coming out, I think in April, is King of Games 92. Actually, when this episode drops, I think the first couple episodes will be starting to drop on the free feed. Right now it's all on Patreon, but at the time of recording this, it's all on Patreon. But at the time I think this episode comes out, some of the episodes will be out on their free feed. But basically it takes all the games, or they look at the games from a specific year. So in this one that's being released soon is King of Games 92. And it is basically pitting games against each other that all came out that year. So we basically took a look at like the top 20 is a relative thing. They basically took a poll of all the panelists and like content creators that were participating in it. And we all, you know, we picked like a list of like 25 of our favorite games from 1992 out of like the list that we could find. And then we rank them all, and then they go head to head against each other, you know, but they don't really necessarily rate it based off of gameplay, because that'd be a little hard to, you know, how do you compare Final Fantasy to Donkey Kong Country? I know that neither of those came out. Well, Final Fantasy V came out in 92, but, you know, those games are so dissimilar. Like, how do you really rate them or rank them? So the way they do it is they look at a set of criteria of like personal attachment, critical commercial reception, legacy, and then which would you rather play today? Like, if you could sit down and just pop a game in, pop either of those two in, which would you rather play? And then at the very end, you vote which moves on. And doesn't matter, the previous votes don't matter. It's more just a method. It's an avenue for conversation. But they break down, and there's a whole tournament. There's like 20 some odd games, and you know, 92 was a banger year for video games. You had Mortal Kombat, you had Street Fighter, you had Final Fantasy V, you had Dragon Quest V, you had what else was on there? Sonic the Hedgehog 2. Streets of Rage 2. Like, there's so many good games that came out in 92. And fun fact, one of the games on the list, I'm not going to say mention any of the ones that won their rounds and moved on. I'll keep that spoiler free. But Dune 2 is on that list. You know, the original RTS, the closest thing to the original RTS, Dune 2 is on the list. And that's only because I put it so high on my list. I had to get it on there. Sorry, that was a long-winded rant, but you just kind of talking about it just took me down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's okay.
So I'm going to wrap up this episode. That was such a random tangent. I'm going to wrap up this episode, though. Michael, thank you so much again for joining me. I really enjoyed talking to you and talking about your book. Before we do the shout outs and everything and like plugs and everything, is there anything about the secrets of video game consoles that we did not get to talk about that you would like the audience to know? Any tidbits that you would like to get out there?
I mean, I don't want to spoil too much of the book. So I'd just say, yeah, like, if you're interested in, you know, the kind of thing that I was interested in, like wanting to know the stories behind the stories, as it were, with all these facts, like many of them obscure that you may not know, or facts that you do know but you don't know the whole story of, like, then this book will be right up your alley. So, yeah, go and check it out.
All right. So now I'm going to give the floor back to you one more time. Where can everybody find you online? And I will make sure, of course, to include in the show notes some links in the show notes for where people can buy that.
And there is an ebook version as well.
Perfect. And the lastly, before I give all my plugs, I always like my guests to go first. Where can people find you online? Is there any social media that you like to plug?
I try to stay off social media as much as I can, to be honest, but I do have my YouTube channel, which you mentioned, which is white_pointergaming. So you can check me out there.
All right. And honestly, you're probably smarter for staying off social media. I wish I was less addicted to it. As usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, please consider giving it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts, because not only is that free to you, it also makes me feel warm and fuzzy, and that I like feeling warm and fuzzy. So give it a 5-star rating review over anywhere good podcasts are given away for free. You can, if you want to support the show monetarily, for just a few dollars, for $1 a month, you'll get all the episodes a few days earlier at a higher bit rate, as well as access to voting rights for whenever I do patron poll episodes. And there's also a Discord where you can get some patron roles on there. For $4 a month, you get everything at the $1 level, plus two bonus episodes a month, which covers a variety of different topics, personal to weird ideas that I've been doing. Like, I've been playing through the Gamer 5 Portable from My Arcade, which is basically one of those little consoles that has like like 220 in one. And you know it's quality when there's 220 games in one handheld system. So that's been a fun journey. I guess that's the closest word I can use to describe it. It's been a fun journey so far. And then finally, for the $5 level, you'll get everything at the previous two, plus access to a patron-exclusive podcast called Still Bonding. Still Bonding is a James Bond podcast where two friends bond over 007. And at the time this episode's coming out, I believe Live and Let Die, we're up to Live and Let Die. So we're working our way through the Bond film. So if you like James Bond, or if you just want a shitload of content, because each episode is 2.5 to 3 hours long, and there's a lot to talk about in those movies, that's for you. So patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But of course, the most important shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that is all the time I have for you on this episode of Still Loading. Michael, thank you once again for joining me.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
And I will see you all next time.